Lori Winkless is with us. Of course, she is a physicist. She's a science commentator. She is author of the wonderful book, Sticky?
Yeah, Sticky. Good memory.
And we're going to learn why procrastinating before bedtime might be bad for you. Is this like where you put off going to bed because you're too lazy to even get up and turn off the telly and go to bed?
It's kind of that, but it's also like if you think about normal procrastination, it's that idea that we put something off even if we know it's going to come back and bite us in the butt later. But bedtime procrastination is a subset of this. And it is that idea that as bedtime approaches, some people do anything they can to kind of claw back their day. So usually that will involve something like playing a game or watching an extra episode of that show, or even sometimes just kind of mindlessly scrolling through, you know, social media, etc. And the main thing about this type of procrastination is that there's no external factors involved, right? So it's not, this is not about people who work shift work or who have kids keeping them up late. This is a deliberate decision, yes, to kind of claw back their time.
Do we know why we do it? I used to do it, I can tell you, when I was younger, because if I went to bed, then I'd go to sleep and then I'd wake up and be school again. So it was like a bit of free time to try and squeeze
in. Are you a night person or a morning person?
I've become a morning person. I used to be a night person, to my
So in
regret.
This study, the study that these researchers did at the University of Queensland, they found that if you are a kind of an evening person or someone who has an evening chronotype, you're much more likely to do this bedtime procrastination.
Keep going.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly. And I'm married to one of those. I'm a morning person. My husband is a night person. So I see this. And in this study, what was really interesting about it is it's a meta-analysis. So they gathered together 43 other studies and looked at the overall trends. And so if you're a night person, you're more likely to do it. But they also looked at what that meant in terms of sleep outcomes. And one of the things they found is that greater bedtime procrastination is associated with lower sleep duration, poorer sleep quality, and higher levels of daytime fatigue. So they're not saying that these two things, you know, are directly linked. They're saying there's a correlation between them. So they can't quite say that one causes the other.
Well, if you were a procrastinator because you normally go to bed at 8 and instead you go to bed at 9, you're probably going to have less outcomes. And does this just come back to more we're learning about circadian rhythm, that we can't, there's a limit to how much we can reset that body clock, need for light, all that kind of thing?
Yeah, there is. And there's also an appreciation that we really do have different clocks. Some of us really genuinely are night people and some of us are morning people. And unfortunately, most of society is kind of designed for morning people.
Very good. Now, who's done this study?
So it's the University of Queensland, but actually I should just want to say the lead author, Vanessa Hill, she is an amazing science communicator. She's got a YouTube channel called Braincraft, where she talks about sleep and science. So highly recommend looking her up on social media.
As long as you're not procrastinating because you just want to look at another one of her videos.
It would be ironic.
It would be completely ironic. All right. Now, we love jellyfish stories. Extraordinary species that they are. And what is this little tiny jellyfish relative you want to introduce us to?
So you've probably never heard of it, but it's actually surprisingly common in most of the world's oceans. And it's called Nanomia bijuga. And I apologise if I've mispronounced that. But if you could see a picture of it, you would recognise that it's related to jellyfish because it does have that kind of ethereal look to it. And like some jellyfish and also squid, Nanomia gets through the water by using jet propulsion. So it rapidly shoots little pockets of water out of dedicated nozzles to get around. But Nanomia's propulsion is really special because while other species have one or two of these jet nozzles, it turns out that Nanomia has between 10 and 20 of them, depending on the length of the body. And they're all distributed in the front portion of the body, which, if you could see it, would look like a very kind of tightly clustered collection of blobs, gelatinous blobs.
It's actually like a really pretty sort of ball frock, really. And you've got all the sort
incredible.
Of jewels at the top. And then you've got
a long tail
frock at the back.
It's stunning. Like, they're really beautiful and they're very small. But what's really cool is each of these blobs is actually its own animal, because Nanomia are like coral. They're actually made up of much tinier, identical creatures that all work together. But in this species, each one of these blobs is actually a little jet engine. And what these researchers have just found, and this paper was literally just published yesterday by US-based marine biologists, they found that Nanomia can actually pulse its jets at different rhythms depending on the type of swimming it needs to do. So if it needs to escape from a predator, it's all hands
full
on deck.
Steam.
Absolutely. So they shoot everything simultaneously. But that is not something you want to do all the time because it costs a lot in terms of energy. So when Nanomia is doing its kind of everyday stuff like floating through the water and long distance swimming, it actually pulses its jets kind of sequentially in a particular pattern based on where the jets are on the body. And that form of propulsion uses very, very, very little energy, which is really cool. And the other thing to remember as well is that animals like this, they don't have a centralized nervous system. So they're doing it without having a kind of a central brain. And the researchers who wrote this paper have suggested that maybe we could take inspiration for it for future underwater vehicles.
Yeah, whether you could mimic what all those individual little creatures are doing. Mm. I wonder how they do communicate. I wonder if they release some kind of nervous energy or something, because how do they know to go boom all at once?
Yeah, I don't know. And they haven't. It's not something that they've covered in this particular study, but I really want to look into this little creature a bit more.
I love the fact that it is a siphonophore or a siphonophore or however you want to say it, that little siphon thingy, and it's from the same phylum as jellyfish.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful stuff. Are they found... Where are they found, mainly?
They're kind of mostly in the Indian Oceans, the Atlantic Oceans, fairly kind of warm and temperate waters.
Yeah. Such a pretty looking little creature
with
a rather peculiar little head, I have to say. Now, from the most important practical story of the week, well, actually we've been debating over whether it's a urinal or a urinal, and it's different in the United States and the UK, but we just cannot go past the fact, as I understand it, that this research into the urinal has been carried out by the University of Waterloo.
I know.
Which you just couldn't script, could you?
It's delightful. And actually, what's really nice to see is the researchers themselves lean quite heavily into that. I got to actually see their presentation slides because this is hot off the presses. They've literally just presented this research at a conference. And yeah, they've leaned quite heavily into all of the puns you can imagine.
You know how sometimes a name suggests what you should do for a living.
Absolutely.
Or what you should explore in research. So... You know, let's hear about it. It's the splash-free urinal. Urinal.
I'll say urinal, you say urinal, okay. And we'll be covered.
Okay.
But yeah, so it is, just to say, it is really genuinely difficult to design a urinal that works perfectly for everyone, because anyone who needs to pee standing up, you know, they are different heights, they have different body proportions.
Back to that propulsion issue we were discussing.
Yeah, indeed, the qualities of the flow change, etc., etc. And the splash bag itself costs a lot in terms of cleaning, and there's hygiene issues. So it is a genuine issue that kind of needs to be solved.
Stainless steel, aren't they? I mean, I don't spend a lot of time hanging around urinals.
A lot of them are kind of made from a porcelain. Sometimes they're stainless steel, but they are. There's a lot of different designs around. But yeah, so what these guys wanted to do was to try to understand the basics of it. So first of all, what they did was they looked at what the impinging angle, what impact that might have. So the angle that the urine hits the urinal.
We've got to say.
Yeah. And what they realise is if you hit below a certain angle of about 30 degrees, there's almost no splashback. So it is possible to change your behaviour in order to reduce that angle and not cause any splashback. And this is something that doggies do without thinking. You know, if you think about how a dog lifts up their hind leg before they urinate, that is actually, if you measure those angles, it's always below that critical impinging angle. So they're doing it to minimise splashback. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't seem to have learned from that at all. So these researchers wanted to design the shape of a urinal that would minimise that angle no matter what else was changing. So even if people weren't bothering to minimise splashback, the urinal would do it for them. So they made four prototypes. Two were based on kind of normal urinals, standard ones, and two were based on their calculations.
The images are on the website, listeners.
Yeah, they're delightful. I highly recommend looking at them. But one is called the Base Clef and the other is called the Nautilu, and this is Nautilu, because this particular design is inspired by the Nautilus, the shell of the Nautilus creature. And what they found was that the Nautilu design, that displayed less than 1% splashback, regardless of how much urine was hitting the surface or how fast it was doing it. No matter what, it had the lowest splashback of all, by far, like many, many times better than any urinal on the market. And as a kind of a bonus, It sounds a bit weird, but they look really beautiful, these urinals.
Is this the one that kind of looks like a shoe?
I mean, no, so this one's very long and tall and narrow.
That's the long, tall one, yeah. Like a long, kind of almost like a canoe, a waka. I don't want to be insulting, but it's almost that same kind of shape.
Exactly.
But then there's one that almost looks like a shoe. It's kind of folded up this around, is what like a clog.
Yes, and they call this the base clef, which I think is pretty optimistic. It was much better than the other two standard urinals too, but it was still outperformed by the Nautilus. So
what's the physics? Is it literally the angle, or trying to compensate for whatever the angle might, whatever splashback might occur?
Exactly. It's the angles that each of the surfaces make in relation to one another. That means that no matter how careless you are, it will always hit the surface with this minimum angle.
It's very hard not to reference weeing contests in this, isn't it? Like, I mean, things may never be the same again. And look, honestly, is it going to lead to... The only thing looking at it, they do, as you say, they look expensive. They look they might be pretty. It's probably going to see wide application, or just perhaps in posh homes, do we know?
Well, yeah, I need to ask the researchers what their plans are. But they built a prototype for the same cost as a normal urinal. So we'll see what that means in the longer term.
Okay, wonderful stuff. Science providing useful solutions, as always, from the University of Waterloo. It just had to be, didn't it? Thank you very much, science commentator Laurie Winkless.